This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Current projections indicate that Africa's population is going to double between now and 2050. Two-thirds of this population growth will be absorbed by urban areas. So that means in the next 30 years, Africa's cities will be home to an additional 950 million people.
That's a senior economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation Development on Africa's growth projections. Details coming up also. There was a call at the African Union Summit for African solutions to African problems. And the dreaded locusts that have ravaged several East African countries have now crossed into Uganda. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Africa is projected to have the fastest population growth in the world over the next 30 years, and the majority of this growth will take place in urban areas. This transition is profoundly transforming to the continent. Nicolas Pinon has more from Paris.
African urbanization is massive and already a reality on the continent. According to a new report from a Paris-based policy group, the Sahel and West Africa Club, more than 50% of Africans already live in one of the 7,600 urban areas across the continent. In the coming decades, existing cities are expected to grow and many new cities to emerge. Philip Henriques is a senior economist at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Urbanization will continue in Africa, and current projections indicate that Africa's population is going to double between now and 2050. Two-thirds of this population growth will be absorbed by urban areas. So that means in the next 30 years, Africa's cities will be home to an additional 950 million people.
These demographic trends create many challenges for city officials, who often lack the policies, funds, or data to cope with rapid expansions. Ivan Akisoyer is the mayor of Freetown in Sierra Leone.
The main challenges that Freetown faces really stems from its inability to plan its growth and consequently the establishment of 68 informal settlements, what people sometimes refer to as slum communities. And as I've said, with the lack of planning, inadequate infrastructure, sanitation.
Many activists see the growing urbanization as a tremendous opportunity to rethink African cities, which some say are overrun by cars and pollution, with road safety being a major issue. Ranji Ramatai is the Vice President and Regional Director for Africa at the World Resources Institute, based in Nairobi.
We must begin to think about mass transit. What are the opportunities for buses and for non-motorized transit like bicycle lanes and simple walk paths? Pedestrian safety in our cities is one of the most depressing things. If you just walked around Nairobi, you would find in some parts very pleasant walk paths, and then abruptly they end, and you're walking in the middle of the road, competing with trucks and buses.
The new report says Africa now has 74 urban agglomerations or urban areas with more than 1 million inhabitants, about the same as the European Union and United States combined. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Vote counting continues today in Cameroon after yesterday's election. The election for the country's legislature and local councils was the first in 7 years. But fighting between government troops and Anglophone separatists in one area of the country, in Northwest, disrupted some voting. A boycott by one of the larger opposition parties also cut into the voting. Journalist Moki Edwin Kenzaka is in Cameroon. He says voting was lower than expected.
What the elections official said was that only about 40% of registered voters, that is about the 7 million people who registered, came out to vote in the French-speaking regions, which means that participation rate is less than 50%, then it was really what one can call a disaster in the English-speaking regions, because most polling stations remained closed. Secondly, elections officials did not even go to their polling stations. And thirdly, the voters, many of them had escaped, had run because of the threats given to them by the separatist fighters that no one should come out and vote. So elections went on in the French-speaking regions with just about 40% of the registered voters participating. And in the English-speaking regions, elections went on just in some polling stations.
Kinzeka says vote counting continues and announcements on results won't be made until every one of about 25,000 polling stations report to the Central Election Unit in the capital, Yaoundé. He says the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, led by President Paul Biya, looks like to dominate.
Out of the 180 seats in parliament, the ruling CPDM is already sure of winning about 140 seats in areas they went uncontested. There was no political party that was contesting in those seats with them. And out of the 380 council areas, local council areas, the CPDM went unopposed in about 200 of them. So at the end of the day, CPDM will still be carrying a majority.
Given Biya's support by the DPDM, Kinzeka says the election may not significantly change the political structure in Cameroon.
Now, what will be happening now is that President Paul Biya announced the holding of regional elections. Regional elections is part of the solution to the Anglophone crisis that he proposed, and Parliament also deliberated and voted that. So there will be regional elections that will be organized very soon from now. What will also change will be the fact that the appointed people, they call them government delegates, to rule over some councils will no longer exist. The government says mayors will vote to head those councils. But the implication, and you want to note that if you're talking about the role of the parliament in changing rules, if the government of Cameroon, if the ruling CPDM party still continues to wield the majority at National Assembly and of the councils, then nothing much is expected to change. They will just accompany President of Cameroon, Paul Biya, to, you know, accomplish what he has as plans for Cameroon unopposed.
We'll bring you more updates on Cameroon's election in the coming days. It's been a whirlwind year for Ethiopia since Abiy Ahmed became prime minister. He has initiated a raft of reforms to overhaul the authoritarian government structure, significantly improved the relations with neighbors, and received widespread international acclaim, including the Nobel Peace Prize. But now human rights organizations such as Amnesty International point to a sharp increase in lawlessness in the country, kidnapping of university students, intensified domestic conflict, and heightened ethnic-based violence gripping the country. To better understand the political situation, I spoke with Ahmed Soliman in London, a researcher on the Horn of Africa with the Africa Program at Chatham House.
You know, we've seen in recent years many incidents occurring and leading to a heightened ethnic-based violence. We've seen, you know, a lack of serious accountability in a number of those incidents. You have, you know, minorities who have been displaced and killed, restrictions or curtailing of the freedom of people to live in different regions, work, study, Tigrayans fleeing the Amhara region, fleeing Gondor, or traders who are not able to, you know, travel or work safely in each other's regions. So I think these are worrying signs for the country.
Is Ethiopia's version of ethnic federalism the culprit here?
I think perhaps what we're seeing is partly as a result of the reforms and the changes that have been taking place, as well as the clamour by many different groups, you know, be they ethno-nationalist groups, be they unionist or federalist groups, for autonomy, for, you know, their slice of the pie, be it regional autonomy, be it territorial resource base, and that clamour is leading to this increased competition and suspicion. And I think that's very, very, as I say, that development itself is troubling for the stability of the country. Now, in part, some of the response from the Ethiopian authorities is specifically around this issue of lawlessness that you mentioned. And that's a very worrying trend ahead of the general election. And you can kind of explain that in part because of the rise of armed militant ethno-nationalism, you know, being a threat to that stability. So what we know is that regions have their own police, militia and special forces, which have been building up. But in response, you also have ethno-national groups building up their own forces. And this leads to this increase in armed confrontation and also to an extra incitement of ethnic-based violence. You have groups seeing other nationalities as a threat and militarizing in order to protect themselves as a response to that. I think these fears and violent responses are amplified. You know, you have numerous influential regional media, you know, politicians, populist politicians who are messaging in certain ways, social media activists as well, who are promoting certain issues of prominence and interest to them. And I think this all feeds into this, you know, trend of violence that we're talking about. And so, yes, I would say that the current uncertainty around the nature of governance and you know, the political direction of the country following, you know, the long rule of the EPRDF and the huge shake-up that has taken place since with the emergence of Abiy Ahmed, I think...
The news has slowly been creeping in social media. Ethiopians taking to the streets to protest their government's failure to find at least a dozen university students and five other people who were believed to have been kidnapped, and the failure of the prime minister's office or his government to rescue a group of students. What does that tell us about Abiy's hold on power?
Yes, I think this is, you know, the latest of these incidents linked to ethnically driven conflict. And I think rightly so, the response, you know, is one of disdain and asking the government, what are they doing and how are they responding, and you know, suggesting that the response that the government has made hasn't been enough to try and, you know, locate these university students who have been kidnapped and to free them. And it's a very difficult situation, I have to say. I mean, I've been tracking some of the response from the government to this, and of course they've held meetings at the university with the Minister of Peace and the Federal Police Commissioner. Of course, the Prime Minister's press secretary as well. They've set up a senior investigation unit to this, overseen by Deputy Prime Minister Demeke Mekonnen. And as I understand, Prime Minister Abiy has, you know, it was announced that he's met with some of the parents of the kidnapped students. But it's whether or not that's enough in the current environment. You know, of course, no group has claimed responsibility for these abductions. You know, what I see is that this is another one of those incidents feeding into suspicion and tension between ethnic groups in the country. In this case, you know, between the Amhara and the Oromo, a number of those students kidnapped were female Amhara students. And again, we see these incidents amplified by certain kind of politically interested parties.
That was Ahmed Suleiman with the Africa Programme at Chatham House. In the second part of our interview tomorrow, we will discuss Ethiopia's upcoming election. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The African Union Summit heard calls for African solutions to African problems and urged countries from outside the region to avoid fighting proxy wars on the continent. 55 African heads of state and government and senior officials, as well as key international figures, including UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, were on hand as the summit opened Sunday in Addis Ababa. With a theme of silencing the guns, they vowed that the AU would play a more prominent role in resolving conflicts. In his opening remarks, AU Commission Chairman Moussa Faki Mahamat said it will take more than military action to address the root causes of African conflicts, namely
poverty and social exclusion. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is AU's new chairman, said he will make South Sudan and Libya top priorities. Ramaphosa also criticized U.S. President Donald Trump's Mideast peace plan, comparing it to apartheid. The dreaded locusts that have ravaged several East African countries have crossed into Uganda. Surveillance teams led by officials from Uganda's Ministry of Agriculture are already in the districts to counter the pests. The infestations have been reported in Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Somalia, among other countries. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Communities in three districts in Karamoja subregion have been thrown in panic by an invasion of desert locusts. The government has confirmed that swarms crossed from Kenya to Uganda yesterday afternoon. Agre Bajire is Uganda's Minister of State for Agriculture.
Our teams of Minister of Agriculture and UPDF got the site and confirmed that it was true. Some small swarms of desert locusts had crossed to Uganda in the district of Amadat. Some of the swarms started on another journey downwards, the district of Nabirato and Nakapipit.
The Uganda government has deployed 2,000 Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF soldiers, to undertake spraying operations. Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda says Uganda is also working with other regional bodies to fight the invasion that has been described as a major threat to food security.
Uganda has already paid $3 million that is part of our contribution to the desert locust control and has also made arrangements to deploy people in the affected areas. UPDF, as usual, is ahead of the situation, is already deployed, and our officers from disaster preparedness are already in the area to ensure that they work with the local leaders to mobilize the population so that this problem can be dealt with.
18,000 liters of chemicals have been dispatched to Karamoja region for the area spraying. The Minister of Agriculture has assured that the chemicals used are safe for humans and the environment. Stephen Tibeijuka is the Commissioner of Crop Protection at the Ministry of Agriculture.
For aerial spraying, the chemical is a special formulation. It is an ultra low volume formulation. It means that the smallest required amount is the only amount released for control of the locusts. It is in very tiny droplets and on a target. All the control in these processes are environmentally acceptable. There should be no worries. Since December, the Republic of Kenya has been spraying and doing controls. And if there was anything, it would have been immediately picked.
Tibeijuka assures that government is adequately prepared to counter the locust invasion and will hopefully eliminate them in the next 2 weeks. Locust swarms can consume vast amounts of crops and grassland, leaving farmers impoverished. Uganda last had a deadly locust invasion in 1950. According to United Nations, locusts travel in swarms of about 80 million per square kilometer and can cover as much as 150 kilometers a day. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
A nationwide poll in Tunisia revealed a relative increase in optimism for the country's future and improved faith in the democratic process. However, the survey also showed persistent distrust of the government's handling of the economy and response to corruption. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the findings with Georgi Todorovic, senior advisor for political parties at the International Republican Institute, which conducted the poll.
Well, definitely after the elections, the optimism has gone a little bit up. Every time Tunisia had the elections, post-election, we had the direction of the country going in the positive direction. We are also seeing that their priorities are all about the economy. It's about living standards. It's about prices of goods. It's about jobs. And it's about the economic opportunity for the youth. And they very clearly connect that also to corruption. When we ask people what would solve these problems, many people say it is actually the corruption that is creating the problems with the economy and is holding the country down. We have noticed that Kais Saied, the president, still has quite a bit of support, but the citizens of Tunisia are a little skeptical towards the politicians these days. The expectations are high, and we see high numbers of Tunisians looking at the next year as a year that will improve the living standard for their household and their family. And I think this is a little bit of the problem for the government that hasn't yet been formed, because when they come to place, many citizens will look at them and say, okay, we want the economy to get better, and the reforms are usually going a little slower than this.
How satisfied was the Tunisian public with the new elected parliament?
The parliament traditionally has a very low numbers and very low support. This is because the Tunisians do not necessarily see members of parliament as directly representing them, and this is because they don't really see the results that the parliament has been making. So the numbers are fairly low for the parliament, but I think that they're still to see the new parliament in action. We're still in the process of negotiations for the new government, and the parliament has been caught up in the negotiations between the political groups. I think there is a chance for the parliament in Tunisia to improve its standing in the next few years, but it will require a lot of outreach, it will require a lot of direct contact with the citizens, and it will require a lot of work in actually rebuilding the trust of representatives.
So what kind of recommendations the Tunisian public offer to satisfy their aspirations?
I believe that the citizens are open for many things. I think that one thing that is missing in Tunisia is a strategy of economic reform. And the government comes to place, I think, will have to sit and think about opening the market, about creating the change in the currency. Currency in Tunisia is not convertible right now. And in tackling the big problem of corruption, if they present a strategy with clear ideas, clear timelines, and if they communicate this to citizens in a way that is understandable, I think that Tunisians will be patient and they will wait. But this is, I think, one important thing. Politicians talk about everything but the issues that people are concerned about. The people keep saying economy, while the politicians keep talking about negotiations, government, changes of the laws and constitution. This is something that I think is the biggest issue and the biggest concern in Tunisia.
With your experience with political parties in Tunisia, how do you explain the failure to come up with a new Tunisian cabinet so far?
I believe that the current parliament is very segmented and fractured. There is no clear majority. We have an Agda that holds 54 seats out of 217. And to form the government right now, there needs to be a lot of agreements and a lot of consensus between different political groups who have different views on how the thing should be done in the country. So I think that the outcome of the elections led to this long negotiation for the government. And also I think that the understanding of high responsibility of whoever is going to lead the government for very necessary reform is something that is sort of preventing people from jumping into a quick deal for the government. The parliament currently has several different blocs that are not in agreement. And the prime minister has just announced last week the group of 10 parties that he's trying to gather around the coalition, which in itself is going to be problematic because the biggest coalition in the government was the four-party coalition that Tunisia had from 2015 to 2019. And I believe that that may be something of a challenge.
That was Georgi Todorovic, senior advisor for political parties at the International Republican Institute, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Everybody, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, tune in and treat yourself to an hour of amazing pan-African music. Current Afropop, coupe décalé, gospel crossover, Afrobeats, bonga flavor, and neo-traditional tunes will delight and excite you. The chill, classic throwback sounds of Wasalum, Maskandi, and Juju music will relax you and make you smile.
That is so beautiful. Oh, say yes. It one more time.
Ngiyabuqabuka ubuhle obuhle.
And Song of the Week, Shekere, by Yemi Alade and Anjali Kijo, will make you want to get up and dance. It's going to be so much fun. So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday at 1505 and 20500 UTC.